Chapter 5. The Forging of a Hammer. He ran easily through the night in spite of the snow that covered the ground. He was one with the shadows, slipping through the forest, the moonlight almost as clear to his eyes as the light of the sun. A cold wind ruffled his thick fur and suddenly brought a scent that made his hackles stand and his heart race with a hatred greater than that for the Neverborn. Hatred and a sure knowledge of death coming. There were no choices to be made. Not now. He ran harder toward death. Perrin awoke abruptly in the deep darkness before dawn, beneath one of the high-wheeled supply carts. Cold had seeped into his bones from the ground, despite his heavy fur-lined cloak and two blankets. And there was a fitful breeze, not strong or steady enough to be called a light wind, but icy. When he scrubbed at his face with his gauntleted hands, frost crackled in his short beard. At least it seemed not to have snowed any more during the night. Too often he had awakened, covered with a dusting despite the shelter of a cart, and snowfall made things difficult for the scouts. He wished he could speak with Elias the same way he talked with wolves. Then he would not have to endure this endless waiting. Weariness clung to him like a second skin. He could not recall when he had last had a sound night's sleep. Sleep, or the lack of it, seemed unimportant anyway. These days, only the heat of anger gave him the strength to keep moving. He did not think it was the dream that had wakened him. Every night he lay down expecting nightmares, and every night they came. In the worst, he found Fail dead, or never found her. Those woke him up in shivering sweats. Anything less horrible, he slept through, or only half-woke, with Trollocs cutting him up alive for the cookbot, or a Drakkar eating his soul. This dream was fading quickly, in the manner of dreams, yet he remembered being a wolf and smelling... what? Something wolves hated more than they did Murdral. Something a wolf knew would kill him. The knowledge he had had in the dream was gone. Only vague impressions remained. He had not been in the wolf dream, that reflection of this world where dead wolves lived on and the living could go to consult them. The wolf dream always remained clear in his head after he left, whether he had gone there consciously or not. Yet this dream still seemed real, and somehow urgent. Lying motionless on his back, he sent his mind questing, feeling for wolves. He had tried using wolves to help his hunt, to no avail. Convincing them to take an interest in the doings of Two Legs was difficult, to say the least. They avoided large parties of men, and for them half a dozen was large enough to stay clear of. Men chased away game, and most men tried to kill a wolf on sight. His thoughts found nothing, but then, after a time, he touched wolves at a distance. How far, he could not be sure, but it was like catching a whisper almost on the edge of hearing. A long way. That was strange. Despite scattered villages and manors, and even the occasional town, this was prime country for wolves, untouched forest for the most part, with plenty of deer and smaller game. There was always a formality to speaking with a pack you were not part of. Politely, he sent his name among wolves, Young Bull, shared his scent, and received theirs in reply. Leaf Hunter, and Tall Bear, White Tail and Feather, and Thunder Mist, a cascade of others. It was a sizable pack, and Leaf Hunter, a female with a feel of quiet certainty, was their leader. Feather, clever and in his prime, was her mate. They had heard of Young Bull, were eager to speak with the friend of the fabled Long Tooth. The first Two Legs who had learned to speak with wolves after a gap of time that carried the feel of ages vanished into the mists of the past. It was all a torrent of images and memories of sense that his mind turned into words, as the words he thought somehow became images and sense they could understand. "There is something I want to learn," he thought, once the greetings were done. What would a wolf hate more than the Neverborn? He tried to recall the scent from the dream, to add that, but it was gone from his memory. Something that a wolf knows means death. Silence answered him, and a threat of fear blended with hatred and determination and reluctance. He had felt fear from wolves before. Above all things, they feared the wildfire that raced through a forest, or so he would have said. But this was the prickling sort of fear that made a man's skin crawl, made him shiver and jump at things unseen. Laced with the resolution to go on no matter what, it felt close to terror. Wolves never experienced that kind of dread, except that these did. One by one they faded from his consciousness, a deliberate act of shutting him out, until only Leaf Hunter remained. "The last hunt is coming," she said at last. And then she also was gone. "Did I offend?" he sent. "If I did, it was in ignorance." But there was no reply. These wolves, at least, would not speak with him again, not any time soon. "The last hunt is coming." That was what wolves called the last battle, Tarmangaidan. They knew they would be there, at the final confrontation between the light and the shadow, though why was something they could not explain. Some things were fated, as sure as the rise and fall of the sun and the moon, and it was fated that many wolves would die in the last hunt. What they feared was something else. Perrin had a strong sense that he also had to be there, was meant to be at least, but if the last battle came soon, he would not be. He had a job of work in front of him that he could not shirk, would not, even for Tarmangaidan. Putting nameless fears and the last battle alike out of his mind, he fumbled his gauntlets off and felt in his coat pocket for the length of rawhide cord he kept there. In a morning ritual, his fingers made another knot mechanically, then slid down the cord counting. 22 knots. 22 mornings since Fael was kidnapped. At the start, he had not thought there was need to keep count. That first day, he had believed he was cold and numb but focused, yet looking back he could see he had been overwhelmed by unbound rage and a consuming need to find the Shido as fast as possible. Men from other clans had been among the Aiel who had stolen Fael, yet on the evidence, most were Shido, and that was how he thought of them. The need to rip Fael away from them before she could be hurt had gripped him by the throat till he almost choked. He would rescue the other women captured with her, of course, but sometimes he had to list their names in his head to make sure he did not forget them entirely. Aleandra Maritha Kigaran, Queen of Gildan, and his liegewoman. It still seemed off-kilter to have anyone oath sworn to him, especially a queen. He was a blacksmith. He had been a blacksmith once. But he had responsibilities toward Aleandra, and she would never have been in danger except for him. Bane, of the Black Rock Sharad, and Chiad, of the Stones River Goshin, Aiel maidens of the spear who followed Fael to Gildan and Amadisia. They had faced Trollocs in the Two Rivers as well, when Perrin needed every hand that could raise a weapon, and that earned them the right to call on him. Arla Shigo and Lasile Alderwin, two foolish young women who thought they could learn to be Aiel, or some strange version of Aiel. They were oath-sworn to Fael, and so was Migdin Dorlan, a penniless refugee Fael had taken under a wing as one of her maids. He could not abandon Fael's people. Fael ni Bashir Tabara. The litany came back to her, his wife, the breath of his life. With a groan, he clutched the cord so tightly that the knots impressed themselves painfully on a hand hardened by long days swinging the hammer at a forge. Light. 22 days. Working iron had taught him that haste ruined metal, but in the beginning he had been hasty, traveling southward through gateways created by Grady and Niald, the Tuashiman, to where the farthest traces of the Shido had been found, then leaping south again, the direction their tracks went, as soon as the Ashiman could make more gateways. Fretting every hour it took them to rest from making the first and holding them open long enough for everyone to pass through, his mind was eaten up with freeing Fael at any cost. What he found were days of increasing pain as the scouts spread farther and farther through uninhabited wilderness, without locating the slightest sign that anyone had been that way before, until he knew he had to retrace his path, frittering away more days to cover ground the Ashiman had taken him across in a step, searching for any indication of where the Shido had turned aside. He should have known they would turn. South took them toward warmer lands, without the snow that seemed so strange to Aiel, yet it took them closer to the Seanchan and Ibudar as well. He knew about the Seanchan, and he should have expected the Shido to learn. They were after pillage, not a fight with Seanchan and Damani. Days of slow marching with the scouts fanning out ahead, days when falling snow blinded even the Aiel and forced them all to a chafing halt, until finally Jandin Baron found a tree scraped by a wagon, and Elias dug a broken Aiel spear shaft from beneath the snow. And Perrin at last turned east, at most 2 days south of where he had traveled to the first time. He had wanted to howl when he realized that, yet he kept a tight hold on himself. He could not give way, not so much as an inch, not when Fael was depending on him. That was when he began to husband his anger, began to forge it. His kidnappers had gained a long lead because he was hasty, but since then he had been as careful as he had been in a smithy. His anger was hardened and shaped to a purpose. Since finding the Shido's trail again, he had traveled no farther in one jump than the scouts could come and go between sunrise and sunset. And it was well that he had been cautious, because the Shido changed directions suddenly several times, zigzagging almost as though they could not decide on a destination. Or maybe they had turned to join others of their kind. All he had to go by were old traces, old camps buried by snow, yet all of the scouts agreed the Shido's numbers had swollen. There had to be at least two or three septs together, maybe more. A formidable quarry to hunt. Slowly but surely, though, he had begun overtaking them. That was what was important. The Shido covered more ground on the march than he would have thought possible, given their numbers in the snow, yet they did not seem to care whether anyone was tracking them. Perhaps they believed no one dared. Sometimes they had camped several days in one spot. Anger forged to a purpose. Ruined villages and small towns into states littered the Shido's path as if they were human locusts. Storehouses and valuables looted, men and women carried off along with the livestock. Often no one remained by the time he arrived, only empty houses, the people seeking somewhere for food to survive until spring. He had crossed the Eldar into Altara, where a small ferry used by peddlers and local farmers, not merchants, once ran between two villages on the forested riverbanks. How the Shido had gotten across, he did not know. But he had the Ashaman make gateways. All that remained of the ferry were the rough stone landings on either bank, and the few unburned structures were deserted except for three slat-ribbed feral dogs that slunk away at the sight of humans. Anger hardened and shaped for a hammer. Yesterday morning he had come to a tiny village where a double handful of stunned, dirty-faced people had stared at the hundreds of lancers and bowmen riding out of the forest at first light, behind the red eagle of Manethrin and the crimson wolf's head, the silver stars of Gildan and the golden hawk of Mayen, followed by long lines of high-wheeled carts and strings of remounts. At first sight of Gaul and the other Aiel, those people overcame their paralysis and began running for the trees in panic. Catching a few to answer questions had been difficult. They were ready to run themselves to death rather than let an Aiel near. Brighton had consisted of only a dozen families, but the Shido had carried off 9 young men and women from there, along with all of their animals, only 2 days ago. 2 days. A hammer was a tool with a purpose and a target. He knew he had to be careful, or lose Fael forever, but being too careful could lose her too. Early yesterday, he had told those who were going ahead to scout that they were to go farther than before, push on harder, returning only with a full turn of the sun, unless they found the Shido sooner. In a little while the sun would rise, and at most a few hours after that, Elias and Gaul and the others would return. The maidens and Two Rivers men, he knew, could track a shadow across water. As fast as the Shido moved, the scouts could move faster. They were not encumbered with families and wagons and captives. This time they would be able to tell him exactly where the Shido were. They would. He knew it in his bones. The certainty flowed in his veins. He would find Fael and free her. That came before anything, even living, so long as he lived long enough to accomplish it. Yet he was a hammer now, and if there was any way to accomplish it any way at all, he intended to hammer these Shido into scrap. Tossing the blankets aside, Perrin tugged his gauntlets back on, gathered his axe from where it lay beside him, a half-moon blade balanced by a heavy spike, and rolled out into the open, rising to his feet on trampled frozen snow. Carts stood all around him in rows, in what had been Brighton's fields. The arrival of more strangers, so many, and armed, with their foreign banners, had been more than the survivors of the little village could absorb. As soon as Perrin would let them, the pitiful remnant had fled into the forest, carrying what they could on their backs and on drag sleds. They had run as hard as if Perrin was another Shido, not looking back for fear he was following them. As he slipped the axe haft through the thick loop on his belt, a deeper shadow beside a nearby cart grew taller and resolved into a man swathed in a cloak that seemed black in the darkness. Perrin was not surprised. The nearby horse lines thickened the air with the smell of several thousand animals, mounts and remounts and cart horses, not to mention the sweet stink of horse dung, but he still had caught the other's scent on waking. Man's smell always stood out. Besides, Aram was always there when Perrin woke, waiting. A waning sickle moon, low in the sky, still gave enough light for him to make out the other man's face, if not clearly, and the brass-pommeled hilt of his sword slanting up against his shoulder. Aram had been a tinker once, but Perrin did not think he would be again, even if he did wear a brightly striped tinker coat. There was a frowning hardness about Aram now that moonshadows could not hide. He stood as though ready to draw that sword, and since Fail was taken, anger seemed a permanent part of his scent. A great deal had changed when Fail was taken. Anyway, Perrin understood anger. He had not really, before Fail was taken. "They want to see you, Lord Perrin," Aram said, jerking his head toward two dim forms farther away between the lines of carts. The words came out in a faint mist in the cold air. "I told them to let you sleep." It was a fault Aram had, looking after him too much, unasked. Testing the air, Perrin separated out the scents of those two shadows from the masking smell of the horses. "I'll see them now. Have Steppa readied for me, Aram." He tried to be in the saddle before the rest of the camp woke. Partly that was because standing still for long seemed beyond him. Standing still was not catching the Shido. Partly it was to avoid having to share anyone's company he could avoid. He would have gone out with the scouts himself if the men and women already doing that job were not so much better at it than he. "Yes, my lord." A jaggedness entered Aram's scent as he trudged away across the snow, but Perrin barely noticed it. Only something important would make Seben Balwar root himself out of his blankets in the dark, and as for Solanda Derengil. Balwar appeared skinny, even in a bulky coat, his pinched face all but hidden in the deep hood. Had he stood straight instead of hunching, he still would have been at most a hand taller than the Kyrianan woman, who was not tall. With his arms wrapped around himself, he was hopping from one foot to the other, trying to avoid the cold that must be soaking through his boots. Solanda, in a man's dark coat and breeches, made a good effort at ignoring the temperature despite the feathery white that marked every breath. She was shivering, but managed to swagger standing still, with one side of her cloak thrown back, and a gloved hand on the hilt of her sword. The hood of her cloak was lowered, too, exposing hair cut short except for the tail in the back that was tied at the nape of her neck with a dark ribbon. Solanda was the leader of those fools who wanted to be imitation Aiel, Aiel who carried swords. Her scent was soft and thick, like a jelly. She was worried. Balwar smelled intent, but then he nearly always did, though there was never any heat to his intensity, only focus. The skinny little man stopped hopping to make a stiff, hurried bow.
"The Lady Solanda has news I think you should hear from her lips, my lord."
Balwar's thin voice was dry and precise, just like its owner. He would sound the same with his neck on a headsman's block.
"Milady, if you would."
He was only a secretary, Fail's secretary, and Perrin's, a fussy, self-effacing fellow for the most part, and Solanda was a noblewoman, but Balwar made that more than a request. She gave him a sharp sideways glance, shifting her sword, and Perrin tensed to grab her. He did not think she would actually draw on the man, but then again, he was not sure enough of her, or any of her ridiculous friends, to put it out of the question. Balwar merely watched her, his head tilted to one side, and his smell carried impatience, not concern. With a toss of her head, Solanda turned her attention to Perrin.
"I see you, Lord Perrin Golden Eyes," she began in the crisp accents of Kyrian,
but aware that he had little patience for her pretend Aiel formality, she hurried on.
"I have learned three things tonight. First, the least important. Javiar reported that Massima sent another rider back toward Amadicia yesterday. Nerion tried to follow, but lost him."
"Tell Nerion I said he isn't to follow anybody," Perrin told her sharply. "And tell Javiar the same. They should know that. They are to watch, listen, and report what they see and hear no more. Do you understand me?"
Solanda gave a quick nod, a thorn of fear entering her scent for a moment. Fear of him, Perrin supposed, fear that he was angry with her. Yellow eyes on a man made some people uneasy. He took his hand from his axe and clasped both hands behind his back. Javiar and Nerion were more of Fail's two dozen young fools, one Tyran, the other Kyrianan. Fail had used the lot of them for eyes and ears, a fact that still irritated him for some reason, though she had told him to his face that spying was a wife's business. A man needed to listen hard when he thought his wife was joking. She might not be. The whole notion of spying made him uncomfortable, but if Fail could use them so, then so could her husband, when there was need. Just the two, though. Massima seemed convinced that everyone except Dark Friends were fated to follow him sooner or later, yet he might grow suspicious if too many left Perrin's camp to join him.
"Don't call him Massima, not even here," he added brusquely.
Lately the man claimed Massima Dagar was actually dead and risen from the grave as the prophet of the Lord Dragon Reborn, and he was touchier than ever about mention of his former name.
"You get careless with your tongue in the wrong place, and you might be lucky if he just has a few of his bully boys flog you the next time they can find you alone."
Solanda nodded again, gravely, and this time without any fear smell. Light, those idiots of Fael's lack the sense to recognize what they should be afraid of.
"It's almost dawn," Bulwer murmured, shivering and pulling his cloak tighter. "All will be waking before long, and some matters are best discussed unseen. If my lady will continue..."
Once again, that was more than a suggestion. Solanda and the rest of Fael's hangers-on had been good only for causing trouble, that Perrin could see, and Bulwer looked to be trying to put a fly up her nose for some reason, but she actually gave an embarrassed start and murmured an apology. The darkness truly was beginning to lessen, Perrin realized, at least to his eyes. The sky overhead still looked black, dusted with bright stars, yet he could almost make out the colors of the 6 thin stripes that crossed the front of Solanda's coat. He could tell one from another, anyway. The realization that he had slept later than usual made him growl. He could not afford to give in to weariness, however tired he was. He needed to hear Solanda's report. She would not be worried about Massima sending out riders. The man did that almost every day. Yet he looked anxiously for Aram and Stepper. His ears picked up the sounds of activity among the horse lines, but there was no sign of his horse yet.
"The second thing, my lord," Solanda said, "is that Javier has seen casks of salt fish and salt beef, branded with Altaran markings, a great many of them. He says there are Altarans among the Prophet's people, too. Several appear to be craftsfolk, and one or two could be merchants or town officials. Established men and women in any case, solid folk. And some seem unsure they made the right decision. A few questions might reveal from where the fish and beef came, and perhaps gain more eyes and ears for you."
"I know where the fish and beef came from, and so do you," Perrin said irritably.
His hands knotted into fists behind his back. He had hoped the speed with which he was moving would keep Massima from sending out raiding parties. That was what they were, and as bad as the Shido, if not worse. They offered people a chance to swear to the Dragon Reborn, and those who refused, sometimes those who simply hesitated too long, died by fire and steel. In any case, whether or not they marched off to follow Massima, those who swore were expected to donate generously in support of the Prophet's cause, while those who died were plainly Dark Friends, their belongings forfeit. Thieves lost a hand, by Massima's laws, but none of what his raiders did was thieving, according to Massima. By his laws, murder and a whole host of other crimes merited hanging, yet a fair number of his followers seemed to prefer killing to receiving oaths. There was more loot that way, and for some of them, murder was a fine game to play before eating.
"Tell them to keep clear of these Altarans," Perrin went on. "All sorts drift into Massima's following, and even if they are having second thoughts, it won't take them long to stink of zeal like the rest. They wouldn't hesitate to gut a neighbor then, much less somebody who's asked the wrong questions. What I want to know is what Massima's doing, what he's planning."
That the man had some scheme seemed obvious. Massima claimed it was blasphemy for anyone except Rand to touch the One Power, claimed he wanted nothing more than to join Rand in the East. As always, thought of Rand brought colors whirling through Perrin's head, more vividly than usual this time, but anger melted them to vapor. Blasphemy or no, Massima had accepted traveling, which was not just channeling, but men channeling. And no matter what he claimed, he had done it to remain in the West as long as possible, not to help rescue Fael. Perrin tended to trust people until they proved unreliable, but one sniff of Massima had told him the fellow was as insane as a rabid animal, and less trustworthy. He had considered ways to stop that scheme, whatever it was, ways to stop Massima's killing and burning. Massima had 10,000 or 12,000 men with him, maybe more. The man was not very forthcoming about numbers, and the way they camped in a squalid sprawl made counting impossible. While less than a quarter of that number followed Perrin, several hundred of them cart drivers and grooms and others who would be more hindrance than help in a fight. Yet with 3 Aes Sedai and 2 Ashaman, not to mention 6 Aiel Wise Ones, he could halt Massima in his tracks. The Wise Ones and 2 of the Aes Sedai would be eager to take part. More than simply willing, at least. They wanted Massima dead. But dispersing Massima's army would only break it into hundreds of smaller bands that would scatter across Altara and beyond, still looting and killing, just for themselves instead of in the name of the Dragon Reborn. Breaking the Shido will do the same thing, he thought, and pushed the thought away. Stopping Massima would take time he did not have. The man would have to keep until Fael was safe, until the Shido were smashed to kindling. "What's the third thing you learned tonight, Salanda?" he said roughly. To his surprise, the smell of worry coming from the woman thickened. "Javier saw someone," she said slowly. "He did not tell me at first." Her voice hardened for a moment. "I made sure that will not happen again." Drawing a deep breath, she seemed to struggle with herself, then burst out. "Masuri Sedai has visited Massima, the prophet. It is true, my lord, believe me. Javier has seen her more than once. She slips into their camp hooded and leaves the same way. But he has had a good look at her face twice. A man accompanies her each time, and sometimes another woman. Javier has not seen the man well enough to be sure, but the description fits Rover, Masuri's warder, and Javier is certain the second woman is Anura Sedai." She broke off abruptly, her eyes shining darkly in the moonlight as she watched him. Light she was as worried about how he would take it as by what it meant. He forced his hands to unclench. Massima despised Aes Sedai as much as he did dark friends. He nearly considered them dark friends. So why would he receive 2 sisters? Why would they go to him? Anura's opinion of Massima lay hidden behind Aes Sedai mystery and double-jointed comments that could mean anything. But Masuri had said straight out that the man needed to be put down like a mad dog. "Make sure Javier and Nerion keep a sharp eye for the sisters, and see if they can eavesdrop on one of their meetings with Massima." Could Javier be mistaken? No. There were a few women in Massima's camp, relatively speaking, and it passed belief that the tyrant could mistake one of those unwashed, murderous-eyed harridans for Masuri. The sort of women willing to march with Massima usually made the men look like tinkers. "Tell them to take care, though. Better to let the chance pass than get caught at it. They're no good to anyone strung up on a tree." Perrin knew he sounded gruff and tried to make his voice milder. That seemed harder since Fael was kidnapped. "You've done well, Salanda." At least he did not sound as if he were barking at her. "You and Javier and Nerion. Fael would be proud if she knew." A smile lit up her face, and she stood a little straighter, if that was possible. Pride, clean and bright, the pride of accomplishment, almost overwhelmed any other scent from her.
"Thank you, my lord. Thank you."
You would have thought he had given her a prize. Maybe he had, come to think on it. Though, come to think, Fael might not be best pleased that he was using her eyes and ears, or even knew about them. Once the thought of Fael displeased would have made him uneasy, but that was before he learned about her spies, and that little matter of the broken crown that Elias had let slip. Everybody always said that wives kept their secrets close, but there were limits. Adjusting his cloak on his narrow shoulders with one hand, Bulwer coughed behind the other.
"Well said, my lord, very well said. Milady, I'm sure you want to pass on Lord Perrin's instructions as soon as possible. It wouldn't do for there to be any misunderstanding."
Salanda nodded without taking her eyes off Perrin. Her mouth opened, and Perrin was sure she intended to say something about hoping he found water and shade. Light. Water was the one thing they had in plenty, even if it was mostly frozen, and this time of year nobody needed shade even at noon. She probably did intend it because she hesitated before saying,
"Grace favor you, my lord. If I may be so bold, grace has favored the Lady Fael in you."
Perrin jerked his head in a nod of thanks. There was a taste of ashes in his mouth. Grace had a funny way of favoring Fael, giving her a husband who still had not found her after more than 2 weeks of searching. The maidens said she had been made Gaishin, that she would not be mistreated, but they had to admit these Shido already had broken their customs 100 different ways. In his book, being kidnapped was mistreatment enough. Bitter ashes.
"The lady will do very well, my lord," Bulwer said softly, watching Salanda vanish into the darkness among the carts. This approval was a surprise.
He had tried to talk Perrin out of using Solanda and her friends on the grounds they were hot-headed and unreliable.
She has the necessary instincts. Carrionin do, usually. And tyrants, to some extent. At least the nobles, especially once.
He cut off abruptly and eyed Perrin cautiously. If he were another man, Perrin would have believed he had said more than he intended. But he doubted Bulwer slipped in that fashion. The man's scent remained steady, not jiggling the way it would in a man who was unsure.
"May I offer one or two points on her report, my lord?"
The crunch of hooves in the snow announced the approach of Aram, leading Perrin's dun stallion and his own rangy gray gelding. The two animals were trying to nip at one another, and Aram was keeping them well apart, though with some difficulty. Bulwer sighed.
"You can say whatever you need to in front of Aram, Master Bulwer," Perrin said.
The little man bowed his head in acquiescence, but he sighed again, too. Everybody in the camp knew that Bulwer had the skill of fitting together rumors and chance-heard comments and things people had done to form a picture of what had really happened, or what might, and Bulwer himself considered that part of his job as a secretary, but for some reason he liked to pretend he never did any such thing. It was a harmless pretense, and Perrin tended to humor him. Taking Stepper's reins from Aram, he said,
"Walk behind us a while, Aram. I need to talk with Master Bulwer in private."
Bulwer's sigh was so faint that Perrin barely heard it.
Aram fell in behind the two of them without a word as they began to walk, frozen snow cracking beneath their feet, but his scent grew spiky again, and quivery, a thin, sour smell. This time Perrin recognized the scent, though he paid it no more mind than usual. Aram was jealous of anyone except Fael who spent time with him. Perrin saw no way to put a stop to it, and anyway, he was as used to Aram's possessiveness as he was to the way Bulwer hopped along at his side, glancing over his shoulder to see whether Aram was close enough to hear when he finally decided to speak. Bulwer's razor-thin scent of suspicion, curiously dry and not even warm, but still suspicion, provided a counterpoint to Aram's jealousy. You could not change men who did not want to change. The horse lines and supply carts were located in the middle of the camp, where thieves would have a hard time reaching them. And although the sky still looked black to most eyes, the cart drivers and grooms, who slept close to their charges, were already awake and folding their blankets, some tending shelters made of pine boughs, and other small tree limbs harvested from the surrounding forest, in case they might be needed another night. Cook fires were being lit and small black kettles set over them, though there was little to eat except porridge or dried beans. Hunting and trapping added some meat, venison and rabbits, partridges and wood hens and the like, but that could only go so far with so many to feed, and there had been nowhere to buy supplies since before crossing the Eldar. A ripple of bows and curtsies and murmurs of "A good morning, my lord," and "The light favor you, my lord," followed Perrin, but the men and women who saw him stopped trying to strengthen their shelters, and a few began to pull theirs down, as though they had sensed his determination from his stride. They should have known his resolve by now. Since the day he realized how badly he had blundered, he had not spent two nights in one place. He returned the greetings without slowing. The rest of the camp made a thin ring around the horses and carts, facing the encircling forest, with the two rivers men divided into four groups, and the lancers from Gildan and Mayen spaced between them. Whoever came at them, from whatever direction, would face two rivers longbows and trained cavalry. It was not a sudden appearance by the Shido that Perrin feared, but rather Massima. The men seemed to be following him meekly enough, but aside from this news of raiding, nine Gildanin and eight Mayenners had vanished in the last 2 weeks, and no one believed they had deserted. Before that, on the day Fael was stolen, 20 Mayenners had been ambushed and killed, and no one believed it had been anyone but Massima's men who did the killing. So an uneasy peace existed, a strange, thorny sort of peace, yet a copper wagered on it lasting forever was likely a copper lost. Massima pretended to be unaware of any danger to that peace, but his followers seemed not to care one way or the other, and whatever Massima pretended, they took their lead from him. Somehow, though, Perrin intended to see that it endured until Fael was free. Making his own camp too tough a nut to crack was one way of making the peace last. The Aiel had insisted on having their own thin wedge of the strange pie, though there were fewer than 50 of them, counting the guy Shine who served the wise ones, and he paused to study their low, dark tents. The only other tents erected anywhere in the camp were those of Berlane and her two serving women, on the other side of the camp, not far from Brighton's few houses. Fleas and lice in hordes made those uninhabitable,
even for hardened soldiers seeking shelter from the cold, and the barns were putrid ramshackle affairs that let the wind howl through, and harbored worse vermin than the houses. The maidens in Gaul, the only man among the Aiel not Gaishain, were all out with the scouts, and the Aiel tents were silent and still, though the smell of smoke coming from some of the vent holes told him the Gaishain were preparing breakfast for the wise ones, or serving it. Anura was Berlane's adviser, and usually shared her tent, but Masuri and Seonid would be with the wise ones, maybe even helping the Gaishain with breakfast. They still tried to hide the fact that the wise ones considered them apprentices, though everyone in camp must be aware of it by now. Anyone who saw an Aes Sedai actually carrying firewood, or water, or heard one being switched, could make it out. The two Aes Sedai were oath sworn to Rand. Again the colors whirled in his head, an explosion of hues. Again they melted under his constant anger. But Idara and the other wise ones had been sent to keep an eye on them. Only the Aes Sedai themselves knew how tightly their oaths held them, or what room they saw to maneuver between the words, and neither was allowed to hop, unless a wise one said toad. Seonid and Masuri had both said Massima should be put down like a mad dog, and the wise ones agreed. Or so they said. They had no three oaths to hold them to the truth, though in truth that particular oath held the Aes Sedai more in letter than spirit. And he seemed to recall one of the wise ones telling him that Masuri thought that the mad dog could be leashed. Not allowed to hop unless a wise one said toad. It was like a blacksmith's puzzle with the edges of the metal pieces sharpened. He needed to solve it, but one mistake, and he could cut himself to the bone. From the corner of his eye, Perrin caught Balwer watching him, lips pursed in thought. A bird studying something unfamiliar, not afraid, not hungry, just curious. Gathering Stepper's reins, he walked on so quickly that the little man had to lengthen his stride into small jumps to catch up. Two Rivers men had the segment of camp next to the Aiel, facing northeast, and Perrin considered walking a little north, to where Gildan and Lancers were camped, or south to the nearest Mayenner section. But taking a deep breath, he made himself lead his horse through his friends and neighbors from home. They were all awake, huddling in their cloaks, and feeding the remnants of their shelters into the cook fires, or cutting up the cold remains of last night's rabbit to add to the porridge in the kettles. Talk dwindled, and the smell of wariness grew thick as heads lifted to watch him. Whetstones paused in sliding along steel, then resumed their sibilant whispering. The bow was their preferred weapon, but everyone carried a heavy dagger or a short sword as well, or sometimes a long sword. And they had picked up spears and halberds and other pole arms with strange blades and points that the Shido had not thought worth carrying off with their pillage. Spears they were accustomed to, and hands used to wielding the quarterstaff at feast day competitions found the pole arms not much different once the weight of metal on one end was accounted for. Their faces were hungry, tired, and withdrawn. Someone raised a half-hearted cry of golden eyes, but no one took it up, a thing that would have pleased Perrin a month ago. A great deal had changed since Fael was taken. Now their silence was leaden. Young Kenley Merrin, his cheeks still pale, where he had scraped off his attempt at a beard, avoided meeting Perrin's eyes, and Jory Conger, light-fingered whenever he saw anything small and valuable, and drunk whenever he could manage it, spat contemptuously as Perrin passed by. Ban Craw punched Jory's shoulder for it, hard, but Ban did not look at Perrin either. Daniel Lewin stood up, tugging nervously at the thick mustache that looked so ridiculous beneath his beak of a nose. "Orders, Lord Perrin!" The skinny man actually looked relieved when Perrin shook his head, and he sat down again quickly, staring at the nearest kettle as though he were anxious for the morning gruel. Maybe he was. Nobody got a full belly lately, and Daniel had never had much spare flesh on his bones. Behind Perrin, Aram made a disgusted sound very like a growl. There were others here besides Two Rivers folk, yet they were no better. Old Lamgwin Dorn, a hulking fellow with scars on his face, tugged his forelock and bobbed his head. Lamgwin looked like a shoulder thumper, a tavern tough, but he was Perrin's body servant now, when he had need of one, which was not often, and he might just want to keep in a good odor with his employer. But Basil Gill, the stout one-time innkeeper Fael had taken on as their Shambayan, busied himself folding his blankets with exaggerated care, keeping his balding head down, and Fael's chief maid, Linny Eltring, a bony woman whose tight white bun made her face seem even narrower than it was, straightened from stirring a kettle, her thin lips compressed, and raised her long wooden spoon as if to fend Perrin off. Brianna Taberwin, dark eyes fierce in her pale Carianan face, slapped Lamguin's arm hard, and frowned up at him. She was Lamguin's woman, if not his wife, and the second of Fail's three maids. They would follow the Shido till they dropped dead if necessary, and fall on Fail's neck when they found her. But only Lamguin had an ounce of welcome for Perrin. He might have gotten more from Jur Grady. The Ashaman were estranged from everyone else themselves, by who and what they were, and neither had shown any animosity toward Perrin. But despite the noise of people tramping about on the frozen snow and cursing when they slipped, Grady was still wrapped in his blankets, snoring away beneath a pine branch lean-to. Perrin walked through his friends and neighbors and servants and felt alone. A man could only proclaim his faithfulness so long before he just gave up. The heart of his life lay somewhere to the northeast. Everything would return to normal once he had her back. A thicket of sharpened stakes 10 paces deep encircled the camp, and he went to the edge of the Gildan and Lancers section, where angled paths had been left for mounted men to ride out, though Balwer and Aram had to fall in behind him in the narrow way. In front of the Two Rivers men, a man afoot would have to twist and turn to make it through. The edge of the forest lay little more than 100 paces distant, easy bowshot for Two Rivers men, huge trees thrusting a canopy high into the sky. Some of the trees here were strange to Perrin, but there were pines and leatherleaf and elms out there, some as much as 3 or 4 paces thick at the base, and oaks that were larger still. Trees that big killed anything larger than weeds or small bushes that tried to grow beneath them, leaving wide spaces between. But shadows darker than the night filled those spaces. An old forest, one that could swallow armies whole and never give up the bones. Balwer followed him all the way through the stakes before deciding this was as close to alone with Perrin as he was likely to get any time soon.
"The riders Massima has sent out, my lord," he said,
and holding his cloak close, he cast a suspicious look back at Aram, who met it with a flat stare.
"I know," Perrin said. "You think they're going to the White Cloaks."
He was eager to be moving, and that much farther from his friends. He put the hand holding his reins in the saddle bow, but refrained from putting a boot in the stirrup. Stepper tossed his head, also impatient.
"Massima could be sending messages to the Seanchan just as easily."
"As you have said, my lord. A viable possibility, to be sure. May I suggest once again, however, that Massima's view of Aes Sedai is very close to that of the White Cloaks? In fact, identical. He would see every last sister dead if he could. The Seanchan view is more pragmatic, if I may be permitted to call it that. Less in accord with Massima in any case."
"However much you hate White Cloaks, Master Balwer, they aren't at the root of every evil. And Massima has dealt with the Seanchan before."
"As you say, my lord."
Balwer's face did not change, but he reeked of doubt. Perrin could not prove Massima's meetings with the Seanchan, and telling anyone how he had learned of them would only add to his present difficulties. That gave Balwer problems. He was a man who liked evidence.
"As for the Aes Sedai and the Wise Ones, my lord, Aes Sedai always seem to believe they know better than anyone else, except possibly another Aes Sedai. I believe the Wise Ones are much the same."
Perrin snorted brief white plumes in the air.
"Tell me something I don't know, like why Masuri would meet with Massima, and why the Wise Ones allowed it. I'll wager Stepper against a horseshoe nail she didn't do it without their permission."
Anura was another question, but she could be acting on her own. It certainly seemed unlikely she was acting at Berlane's behest. Shifting his cloak on his shoulders, Balwer peered back across the rows of sharpened stakes into the camp, toward the Aiel tents, squinting as if he hoped to see through the tent walls.
"There are many possibilities, my lord," he said testily. "For some who swear an oath, whatever is not forbidden is permitted, and whatever is not commanded can be ignored. Others take actions they believe will help their liege without first asking permission. The Aes Sedai and the Wise Ones fall into one of those categories, it seems. But further than that, I can only speculate as matters stand."
"I could just ask. Aes Sedai can't lie, and if I press hard enough, Masuri might actually tell me the truth."
Balwer grimaced as though at a sudden stomach pain.
"Perhaps, my lord, perhaps. More likely is that she would tell you something that sounds like the truth. Aes Sedai are experienced in that, as you know. In any event, my lord, Masuri would wonder how you knew to ask, and that line of thought might lead to Javiar and Nerion. Under the circumstances, who can say who she might tell? Straightforward is not always the best way. Sometimes certain things must be done behind masks. For safety.
I told you the Aes Sedai couldn't be trusted, Aurum said abruptly. I told you that, Lord Perrin.
He fell silent when Perrin raised a hand, but the stink of fury from him was so strong that Perrin had to exhale to clear his lungs. Part of him wanted to draw the scent deep and let it consume him. Perrin studied Bulwer carefully. If Aes Sedai could twist the truth till you could not tell up from down, and they could and did, how far could you trust? Trust was always the question. He had learned that in hard lessons. He took a firm check on his anger, though. A hammer had to be used with care, and he was working a forge where one slip would tear the heart out of his chest.
And might matters change if some of Salanda's friends began spending more time among the Aiel? They want to be Aiel, after all. That ought to give them enough excuse. And maybe one of them can strike up a friendship with Berylaine, and with her advisor.
That should be possible, my lord, Bulwer said after the slightest hesitation. Lady Midori's father is a High Lord of Tyr, giving her sufficient rank to approach the First of Mayen, and also a reason. Possibly one or two of the Kyrianen stand high enough as well. Finding those to live among the Aiel will be easier still.
Perrin nodded. Infinite care with the hammer, however much you wanted to smash whatever lay within reach.
Then do it. But Master Bulwer, you've been trying to guide me to this since Salanda left us. From now on, if you have a suggestion to make, make it. Even if I say no to 9 in a row, I'll always listen to a 10th. I'm not a clever man, but I'm willing to listen to people who are, and I think you are. Just don't try poking me in the direction you want me to go. I don't like that, Master Bulwer.
Bulwer blinked, then of all things, bowed with his hands folded at his waist. He smelled surprised. And gratified.
Gratified? As you say, my lord, my previous employer disliked me suggesting actions unless I was asked. I won't make the same mistake again, I assure you.
Eyeing Perrin, he seemed to reach a decision.
If I may say so, he said carefully, I have found serving you pleasant in ways I did not expect. You are what you seem, my lord, with no poisoned needles hidden away to catch the unwary. My previous employer was known widely for cleverness, but I believe you are equally clever, in a different way. I believe I would regret leaving your service. Any man might say these things to keep his place, but I mean them.
Poisoned needles? Before entering Perrin's service, Bulwer's last employment had been as secretary to a Mirandian noblewoman, fallen into hard times, who could no longer afford to keep him.
Mirandi must be a rougher place than Perrin thought. I see no reason for you to leave my employ. Just tell me what you want to do and let me decide. Don't try to prod. And forget the flattery.
I never flatter, my lord. But I am adept at shaping myself to my master's needs. It is a requirement of my profession.
The little man bowed once more. He had never been this formal before.
If you have no further questions, my lord, may I go to find the Lady Midori?
Perrin nodded. The little man bowed yet again, backing away, then went skittering toward the camp, his cloak fluttering behind him as he dodged through the sharpened stakes, like a sparrow hopping across the snow. He was a strange fellow.
I don't trust him,
Aram muttered, staring after Bulwer.
And I don't trust Salanda and that lot. They'll throw in with the Aes Sedai, you mark my words. You have to trust somebody, Perrin said roughly.
The question was who? Swinging into Stepper's saddle, he booted the dun in the ribs. A hammer was useless, lying at rest.